Okay, I see.
Yeah, the other question I have is, because you have BRICS, right? So this is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then I think it didn't have South Africa at the start, but then South Africa kind of joined
Okay.
later as this sort of like trying to be kind of a alternative multilateral collection of countries. And then now I think it's like expanded to BRICS Plus, where they've like added another bunch of countries.
But they couldn't come up with a
Or
good
they're inviting, I don't know. What's the
acronym.
situation, Lena? Like so historically, I mean, where do you think this drive comes from? Is it sort of is it Russia that kind of pushed the BRICS, or how would you describe the Russian involvement in it, or in general?
First of all, we must not forget that it's not only Russia, it's a tandem of China and Russia. So they're doing it together. So they are building their vision of the world. And Russia has already pronounced it as the multipolar world order, as it sees itself as the independent and very strong pole of this world, and of course presenting itself as a great power. So basically Russia is building this multipolar world order as it sees, with emphasis on sovereignty, national interests, not interference in the conflicts or in the affairs of other countries. Not to have like one dependency on the financial system, because recently within the BRICS framework there have been a lot of movements on establishing alternative currencies. So they were trying to introduce own currency or to work through the digital currencies, especially for the oil payments. So of course, BRICS doesn't have kind of very rigid institutional structure as, for example, other type of alliances. So it's not alliance, it's rather the institute, like it's a forum. So and with this forum, while it's all the decisions are being greatly negotiated by other members of BRICS, it's like the main policies and, of course, the main decisions are being made by China, Russia, but of course also including the position, including the interest of India. So of course it must be balanced, but the recent enlargement that it also included the countries from the Middle East. So that was quite shocking and surprising for many researchers, as such countries of Egypt, United Arab Emirates entered BRICS, Iran, of course, but Iran is also very active in like in Asian affairs, in Eurasian economics, part of the Eurasian Economic Union.
Yeah, I actually have a question about that, because wasn't it founded like, or established under Bolsonaro? And I know this isn't your area of research, but I wonder how the dynamic has changed as a founding member now that Lula is in power and is not nearly as much of a far, I don't know, not much, not as much of a strong man, I guess, how that changes. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
To be honest, no, and as I'm rather assessing it from the Russian perspective and its vision of building multipolar world order, because like everything started back then from 90s from Primakov, but that time Russia didn't have that capacity of a great power, I mean economically. And after when Putin came to power, of course he consolidated at first domestically. So and then this like great power policies and great power ambitions
Yeah, they could have
being
called
made
it
possible.
Cribs, but they called it Brick because that sounds more strong and stable. Because, sorry, I mean,
Cribs.
it could have been
Complex.
Cribs if they wanted to. But yeah, okay, I see. No, Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and I guess India is sort of a bit like Turkey in a way that it's kind of in this middle, like a bit of a sandwich situation because, you know, you know, there's, you know, wanting to stay at least, you know, somewhat aligned with Western countries, but then having this BRICS involvement and, yeah, the India position is quite, yeah, it's quite interesting. But you think that, you can imagine it just expanding, like, more and more over time in terms of, like, country membership, or do you think that they have, like, just those certain ones that they want and then that's kind of, that's it in a way?
I'm not sure about their institutional capacities, but I know that before, like, any kind of expansion, before making such a decision, there are many internal procedures that they must to sustain again. And, of course, discussed many burning issues, as, for example, again, as I mentioned, the digital currencies that they're trying to introduce. Russia was also trying to establish this grain initiative that, not specially designed for the Middle East, but again to kind of join forces with other nations in order to bring kind of alternative routes and so on, and kind of new forms of cooperation.
Okay.
That is very important. And of course, like, not to be such a diplomat, like, diplomatically isolated.
trying to
kind of strengthen their cooperation with other actors and their relations with many Middle Eastern states, like, are quite stable. Even after the war in Ukraine, you know, I wouldn't say that it affected so much the relations with the countries in the region.
Okay. Yeah.
One more question. So because I know China, they focus also, you know, got Belt and Road Initiative, but also, like, kind of aid projects, like this kind of, you know, because you have USAID, USAID is kind of gone now, and then China is trying to step in to fill that vacuum of being, you know, where, you know, providing...
Russia the influence of, like...
kind of soft power aid provision. Does Russia do anything with that narrative, or are they just kind of not trying to portray any kind of aid agenda, or...
I'm not sure about the humanitarian aid, as I think that China possesses much more resources than Russia does, but in terms of the soft power projection, I would say that the Russia Today in Arabic plays a significant role in the region in terms of spreading the main official narratives of the Russian government. Also, for example, using some kind of anti-colonial sentiments that was probably very much visible after the voting process at the United Nations Security Council on different types of resolutions on the conflicts in Sudan and Israeli Hamas war. So, basically trying to win the support from the region, which makes it, like, very fertile soil, right? For the projection of the image.
I see.
Like, the government as alternative actor that kind of is capable to sustain, like, any kind of the diplomatic isolation and influence of other states in the region, of other players in the region.
Just finally, because I'm just curious, like, what, just your PhD in general, like, what would you say, how is the expectations going in, how is that matched reality in terms of what it's like to study for people who may be considering it out there as well?
To be honest, I, like, started my PhD in my 30s, so I was, and I had already a family back then and son, and I had some working experience. So to be honest, I cannot say that I entered the program with a very clear set of expectations. And pursuing the doctoral studies had been an inspiration like of mine since my master's degree. But of course, life, as we see, life followed a different course. So when I eventually decided to pursue a doctorate, I explored opportunities both in Ukraine and abroad, and I was accepted a PhD program in Hungary, but war in Ukraine changed my plans dramatically. So eventually I found some options in Germany with the funding opportunities. So I pursued them. However, adapting my research proposal to fit the new academic environment required a lot of effort. So that for sure. So I can say that this was really challenging. And perhaps the greatest difference between my expectations and reality was the depth of the research process itself. Because at the beginning, I believed that I simply needed to understand Russia's strategic interest in the Middle East. But instead, I found myself immersed in the enormous body of literature, because archival materials, memoirs, official documents, because basically during my first year I devoted my whole time basically to reading and trying just to understand the Russian rationale behind the strategic decision. So this took a lot of time. And probably another important realization concerned my own motivation, as I often ask myself why I had chosen this path of pursuing the PhD, and the answer was never about obtaining an academic title or becoming the leading expert, nor it was driven by any kind of strong ambition to build a traditional academic career. So probably I have always imagined myself working more closely with foreign policy, international organizations, and different humanitarian initiatives, rather than within the university system. So probably the PhD represented something different for me. So it was not kind of just... And still it is not just a degree, it's probably a period of intellectual development and personal transition. And yeah, so probably it's just the opportunity to rebuild my professional identity after the disruption in my career that I had after the war. And the most important insight or the most valuable lesson that I have learned is that completing a PhD depends on far more than intelligence, even motivation. At first, I believe even that discipline alone will be a decisive factor, but it is not so. While it is really essential, it was not sufficient for myself, I would say so. My main takeaway, at least from now, from the third year of the PhD, is that PhD requires flexibility and self-compassion alongside this resilience. Because, you know, sometimes we overwhelm ourselves with this kind of self-criticism, kind of not pursuing the aims and the goals at the right time. And exactly during the third year of the PhD, I experienced several unexpected personal challenges, including health issues and other difficult life events that basically disrupted that carefully designed structure. So it really became impossible to follow that rigid plan that I had before. So that's changed a lot, especially in my understanding.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to, like, get the PhD. I don't know. Well, my grades were decent enough. I think I could have done it, but I just know myself that I just don't think I could put myself. One, as you said, I don't think I'm that resilient, and two, I don't think I'm that disciplined. So I just went into the private sector, and I think that was the right choice for me because, academia really, really can take it out of you. I feel like I've seen this firsthand. So,
as you say, I think there's multiple things that need to combine for it to be possible. Like you said, like just having discipline not quite enough. You need the right circumstances. You need your health. You need good family situation. Yeah. You know, the resources, like financial, to be able to survive. And you just need all these things to combine. That's the only case in which you can accomplish it. So it's very fragile in a way, that the space of being in it.
And I think, for every person it's so different. For someone it's just a vocation in life. Right. For someone it's just aspiration. For someone it's a step towards something bigger or towards higher salary.
Right.
But for me it probably was a path again, to shape my identity and to tell my own story, or at least my vision of the topic under studies. So,
But I'm sure it'll come out through your work as well, just the level of... I feel like there'll be a big difference, like, as we go forward, because, AI is able to do more and more of this kind of writing, so there'll probably be more divergence between... PhDs where you can tell someone has been so passionate to create something, and ones where they kind of like just get the AI to shoot out enough to get them the doctorate kind of thing. So,
I'd be pissed if I found out that the person I supervised just put this all into ChatGPT. Like, I don't know. I know it's not that, like... I know it's like they couldn't do the whole thing, like they couldn't write a whole research paper, or like a doctoral thesis, but like, especially if I was old school.
But it's a big controversy now.
I can tell you didn't write this yourself. I can tell you just, I know you are not, this is not you.
No, it's a big controversy now, because there was one paper that came out just in recent days that had it was something like over half of the PhDs it analyzed had some AI written, a certain percentage of AI written content.
And
So I think this is happening, and I can also imagine all the pressures involved.
I mean, it's happening with all levels of education as well. Like teachers of high school students are like, I need you to come into class and write the essay by hand, so I know you're not using a chatbot to write, a paper about this topic, or, we're going back to that handwritten essays
You can't do that for a PhD, force someone to sit in a room to
write. But at least you're forcing PhD. The children to learn how to write. That's the number one thing.
I mean, that's the other risk now, the post articles as well about this post-literate human race that can't
we've evolved to the point where we don't even need to learn how to read or write anymore.
But I think it really depends how you use AI, whether you use it as some kind of assistant, so just to improve the text or to give you some synonym, or whether you are using it to produce the knowledge. I think that's radically different.
Definitely.
I don't know, I can say at least for my historical research, it's really, I don't think even it's feasible to use it for some historical kind of factual progression, or of course to see how the foreign policy evolutionized, for example, through the discourses, because it's impossible just to download all the all this body of the literature to one AI, because it will never give you that threat, as a person will, would imagine it.
But thanks so much for joining us today, Lena.
Thank you very much.
Super interesting topics, and a lot of kind of food for thought. And
And it's nice to hear from another person who settled into Hamburg and also loves it here, and you know, another Hamburg success story, I guess. Well, you know, if you decide to stay here. Yeah. But at least for these last couple of years, it's been good, it sounds like. It doesn't need to be like you need to stay here forever for it to be
successful.
We're
all a B1. We're all B1.
We're not a
success
B1.
Stories. We don't have certificates, but I passed a B1. You passed a B1 test, right, at some point?
I finished a B1 class. I didn't take a test.
Okay.
And again, I have backslid a lot. So we'll see when I finally get back on that. I need to be more disciplined. Remember when I said I'm... have issues with discipline, this is what I'm talking about.
Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
It was my pleasure to participate. Yeah, and I wish you all the best and good luck with the next guest who is exploring new topics within your framework.
Thank you so much.
It was really nice. Thanks.
Yes.
And good luck with the rest of the PhD.
Yes, best of luck to you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, head off. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Yes. Have a nice evening. Good night. We'll be right back.
were lovers. That is that. For nothing will keep us together. We could steal time just for one day.
all you wear is dark, but have no fear.
There's something inside you, it's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy, but you're still the same. There's something inside you, it's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy, but you're still the same.
I'm giving you a night call, tell you how I feel. I want to drive you through the night, down the hills. I gotta tell you something you don't want to hear. I'm gonna show you where it's dark, but have no fear.
There's something inside you, it's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy, but you're still the same. There's something inside you,
kohtad paisi.
Ich haben, musste gar nicht erst nachfragen. Ich fress Tabletten und überhaupt, Mann, ich schaff mir keine kleinen Kinder an. Nein, 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 warum soll ich meine Pflicht als atmen? Für wen? Für die? Für dich? Für mich? Ich hab keine Lust, meine Pflicht zu erfüllen. Für dich nicht, für mich nicht. Ich hab keine Pflicht. Jetzt ist es Zeit, endlich mal aufzumotzen. Ich fress Tabletten und überatmen. Ich schaff mir keine kleinen Kinder an. Nein, 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 warum soll ich meine Pflicht als Frau erfüllen? Für wen? Für dich? Für dich? Für mich? Ich hab keine Lust, meine Pflicht zu erfüllen. Für dich nicht, für mich nicht. Ich hab keine Pflicht. Marlene andere Pläne, Simone Beauvoir sagt Gott bewahr. Und vor dem ersten Kinderschreien muss ich mich erstmal selbst befreien. Und augenblicklich fühl ich mich unbeschreiblich weiblich, weiblich. Erstmal selbst befreien. Oh.